So do you actually have a drink?
I don't know if you can hear my little ice cubes going.
Wow. Okay. So
I got a little whiskey going on here.
Okay. So I have my drink in the other room. I wasn't sure if you were going to, and I didn't want to drink by myself because I hear that's a warning sign. I'll be back in 1 minute. There we go. I was moving so fast, I just destroyed one of my favorite mugs.
Oh, no. Would you describe it as a stein?
You know, I didn't go that far. Do you do that? I've never actually bought dishes in my life, but like if for me, like I've accumulated like mugs or dishes over the years, and some of them have weird sentimental attachments.
I see, Pat, this is where it's amazing to me sometimes that we can be friends, because the amount of like intellectual rigor that's going into purchasing silverware for the house that I'm working on so that it like matches the kitchen and it's like ergonomically sound and made of good materials. Like I've only begun the research process. Like I've only gone through 3 catalogs.
No, see, and here I think we are actually in alignment. Mm-hmm. Because like when I moved into the house that I'm in now, you know, it was time for us to buy a couch. And so I'm like, okay, I guess we'll buy a couch. And I was stunned and horrified to discover that couches could cost perhaps even hundreds of dollars.
Oh no.
And we spent 6 months looking for couches, and Sarah and I never actually bought one. The only reason we have furniture is because a friend moved and said, would you like the extra set of furniture we have that's in our basement now? So I went down the rabbit hole for couches and never emerged. And so I just don't try anymore any sort of civilized adult purchases.
I'm looking at the Alessi catalog Coyo Alto furniture set. It was designed by Inga Sempe. It derives from the elegant spoon that the designer created for serving risotto. The project for the cutlery, the makeup, the service, developed the basic features of the first spoon distinctive for the contrast between curved and straight lines. If I had to describe this silverware, it's like perfectly geometric, like perfectly spherical spoons, and this like wonderful tapered handles. It's just this like totally beautiful sculpture. I showed this to Veronica and she was like, this is repulsive. The fork comes like straight out, and she described it as like when you get a really muscly man and he has no neck.
You know, I could see that being like a huge, like perhaps even terrifying, like a honey trap for a designer to start looking at these things.
Yeah. And part of me is compelled by trying to find the best silverware and get it. You know, it's interesting to think about it. It's actually an aspect of design that it's like, I have reactions to it. If I see silverware and I'm like, ooh, I like this, or I don't like this, but I don't really know anything about it. So I don't really have any sort of like intellectual reason for, other than just aesthetics, for sort of liking one pair of silverware over another. So it's sort of interesting trying to learn a little bit about it, as it is with a lot of like interior design and home stuff. But it is sort of offensive to me that if I really think most of the silverware that's available to like the average consumer, you know, if you were to go into a Target or a Crate and Barrel or a store like that, which is like, those are, you know, that's already like a step above IKEA. It's offensive to me. Like, it's really bad. It's like,
like badly designed.
Yeah, it's like not functional and it's made of bad materials. Like, why? Like, it's crazy to me that only these like catalogs for rich people, where you have to like know a designer to tell you what catalog to look at, have the acceptable silverware that everyone should have. Like, what do you use more than your silverware? It's like a daily thing. It should be really good and last forever.
So just out of curiosity, what, like, not the furniture the silverware you're thinking of getting, but the silverware you actually have and use daily, do you first off, do you have a matching set of silverware?
No, it's pretty bad. It's like stuff I've accumulated from college. It's like a lot of IKEA stuff. And then Veronica and I moved in together, so her stuff, which looks like an old person's estate sale, is mixed into it's mixed into my stuff, which is like, you know, all like clean line, like kind of geometric, but shitty tin silverware from IKEA. So it's sort of a, it's really depressing. Like opening our silverware drawer. The best thing I can say about it is we do have a nice, like off, here's a life hack for our listeners, Pat. You got to get an office supply organizer, like a pencil organizer, where there's like little columns of row to separate your silverware by type.
Okay,
that's the whole life hack.
I'm gonna let the life hack thing go, but I don't want to.
Can I tell you another? Here's my other life hack.
Oh God,
demi-glass spoon. Everybody should have a set of tiny spoons. Here's the deal. Sometimes you want to eat something, but do you want to eat it with a big spoon? No, you want to eat it with a small spoon. You got to have a whole set of tiny little spoons.
No, Sam.
Do you have tiny little spoons?
No, now you've gone fucking crazy.
What do you do when you're sad and it's late and you start eating like honey or Nutella?
I eat it with a big goddamn spoon.
Yeah, like, see, that's where you go wrong.
No, because, like, I mean, if you're looking to, like, eat your happiness, you want as much as possible.
No, right? you want to maximize. Here's the thing. The longer you feel like you're eating it, the happier you are. So if you could have 50 spoonfuls, that's better than 5 spoonfuls.
Oh, that is interesting. So, but now here, I've got to ask you, right? It sounds like you're kind of in the same position as me. You have this real, you know, motley collection of silverware that you've just kind of accumulated over the years. So you have, I'm guessing, a favorite spoon, right?
Yeah, the little guys.
No, really?
Yeah, I will always go for a tiny spoon.
No, really?
Yeah, I go for the smallest fork and the smallest spoon. Big silverware is for suckers, Pat. That's a sucker's game.
No, like, well, I mean, it's purely, you're looking to min-max your dinner. Whereas for me, like, I want like a certain degree of hand feel in my silverware. And that means no salad forks. Salad forks are for bitches. You know, you just like, it's like, why would anyone want that stubby fork? And my spoons are like, it's pretty much the largest, most solid, long-handled spoon that I can have that will still fit in my mouth. Because, like, you know, like, I'm going to eat soup with that. And, like, I've got things to do. I can't spend a half an hour eating a bowl of soup with a tiny spoon. I was expecting we'd kind of come to unity on this silverware thing when I found out that you didn't have a full set.
No, but I, like, lie. I will sometimes be falling asleep thinking about the apartment or, I don't know, just thinking about life. And I'm like, oh, my God, the silverware doesn't match. And then and I jolt awake.
So do you have like a set of matching glasses?
We're on a mason jar program, and I think that's probably gonna, I don't know if that's gonna stay. I feel like mason jars, if you're in your 20s, it's a very, you know what's, I'll tell you, here's what's good about mason jars. They're cheap, they're functional, they keep hot things hot, cold things cold, they look okay, they're fungible, so if you break one or you lose one or you give one away, you don't have to worry about it. And you can put a lid on it and take leftovers to work or give it to a friend or bring it to a dinner party or something, you know, throw something in a mason jar. And it's, you know, if you don't have Tupperware, it's a good replacement. So that's why I've had mason jars for like the last, you know, whatever, 10 odd years. But like, I'm turning 30. I feel like I should own some glasses.
I've just recently stepped up into mason jars.
What's below mason jars?
Well,
drinking out of old milk jugs.
Luxury. Okay, right. So this was years ago, and some guy, my publisher contacted me and said, yeah, this German interviewer wants to come out and talk to you about your book. And I'm like, really? You know, like, he's from Germany? And they're like, yeah, he reviews books and he wants to come out, you know. And I'm like, does he know where I live? Like, not near anything cool, you know. It's not like he's using this as an excuse to expense a trip to Manhattan or something. It's like, this is the hinterlands, you know, central Wisconsin. They're like, yeah. I'm like, fine, you know, he can come out here, whatever, you know. He must have pissed off the boss or like slept with somebody's niece to get assigned this like shit gig. Like, go to, you know, go to Wisconsin and interview this, this one book fantasy author. And so he shows up and I do an interview. He's, and like, dude is super smart, you know, and I have a ton of fun. And I find out that, you know, he's been doing these interviews for a long time. And what I didn't realize is, he was like a huge, huge big deal. His name is Dennis Scheck. And, you know, like, we don't have a culture that respects book critics around here. I mean, they're, yeah, people know that they're reviewers or whatever, but probably the closest anyone, you know, would come to being famous is Nancy Pearl, the librarian. But, you know, imagine Siskel and Ebert together, you know, is kind of what Dennis Scheck is. He has his own show. He has like a television show in Germany where he reviews books. He's hugely respected. The man speaks a bunch of languages and like is one of the most delightful and crushingly intelligent people I've ever met. But of course, like, I'm just this freaking idiot who's published a book in Wisconsin. And so he's at my house and he's sitting down and, you know, I'm trying to entertain or be social or civilized, kind of the way like a dog would if you taught it to put on a coat. And so I'm like, you know, oh, I should offer him something to drink. Would you like tea? Would you like, we've got some juice, or I could give you a beer. And he's like, oh, some water would be fine. So I go in to the kitchen and I get him a glass of water and I bring it out. And my girlfriend kind of appears and takes the water away and brings it back in a different glass. And then I realize that all of my glasses, really everything that I drink out, are really recycled, like delivery containers that I use for egg drop soup.
No, you're drinking out of deli-tainers?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I mean, not now. I mean, now I've stepped up into the mason jars.
Oh, I see. This is, that really is a new class of luxury for you.
Oh, it's super. They're like really great, you know, like.
What was it? So your girlfriend saved it.
Well, I mean, it was that point where like sort of the dim realization that I was a monster started filtering through to me. Sort of like when you watch the old version of Frankenstein and you see like you see him, like the little girl kind of looks at him in a strange way and you see and he realizes that he's terrifying to all of the rest of humanity. That's kind of what I'm like, oh shit, nobody else actually lives this way, you know. I'm like, I'm not fit for human company.
Now, are you still on the deli-tainers? Do you still employ the use of deli-tainers in your household?
No, we actually, at first, it was sort of like a slow maneuvering. I mean, I accumulate coffee cups because people give them to me or they're a present or you, I don't know, you just kind of, they show up, they reproduce asexually or something. but I don't like to drink out of coffee cups because I want to like have a bunch of liquid all at once. And one of those big quart deli containers is perfect because I'll drink a whole quart of whatever I'm drinking. But you can also get the mason jars too. We've just recently, these last couple of years, swung all the way over into the mason jars.
Now I'm a big fan. You know, people who know me in real life, they may know that I've embraced the deli-tainer lifestyle. I view it as more of a lifestyle than a product. But basically, deli-tainers, everyone has seen them. They're the thing you would get soup in if you order takeout. But it's this sort of like tall, cylindrical, rigid plastic container with a plastic top. And you can do like a quarter of a quart, a full quart, or a half quart. And so you get like small, medium, and large. And these things are incredible. Like everyone listening to this podcast, here's the one thing to take away. If you listen to the whole run of this podcast, you listen to Pat and I talk about all of our insecurities and, you know, the things that we struggle with creatively and professionally. Here's the one thing you need to do, which is please, for the love of God, get rid of your Tupperware. Tupperware is it's a fool's errand. It's part of the Tupperware industrial complex. See, big Tupperware, they want you to keep buying this bullshit where the tops don't all match and it discolors and you have to buy more and you can't dishwash it. Tupperware is it's holding you back. It's like the things you own, Pat, they end up owning you.
Yeah. Speaking as somebody who does actually have a favorite spoon and is sad when he can't use it because it's dirty, you know, you do not form emotional attachment to the deli soup container.
Exactly. They're totally, you throw them out. When I have Tupperware, things get old and gross in the Tupperware, and then I become scared of it, and I leave it in the fridge for longer. And the problem gets worse, because I don't want to take it out and clean my precious Tupperware. No. The Deli-tainer, throw it right out.
Goes right in the garbage. Because, I mean, they're designed to be thrown away everywhere, except they're super sturdy.
Here's the best part. When you buy the Deli-tainers, you get them on Amazon, you get them online. I like the Ready-tainer brand. You get these things. How many do you get? Do you get a set of 5 with matching lids? No. You get 100.
No, Max, like, why would you buy those? You get them. The reason I have these is because I order egg drop soup when I...
fine. I wasn't as good at accumulating them, and I go through them quickly because, like, when I cook, I also use them for all of my little ingredients and stuff. So I'll like burn through these things, but they're reusable, they're dishwasher safe. And here's the best thing: across the entire product line, even across different brands, the lids are exactly the same size. Yeah. The lids are completely interchangeable. And if you lose a lid, do you retire the container? No, you just swap in a new lid.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. Yeah.
And actually, you know, there's very few moments in which I actually feel cool. But one of them was when I was talking with Paul and Storm, and we were having a Skype call. I can't remember what it was about exactly, but, you know, because I'd had a bunch of Skype calls that way, because I know him and we're friends, I was eating a little bit of lunch, or rather, I hadn't quite finished my lunch before we got on the call. And so I again, you know, why would you bother dirtying a dish when you had this perfectly serviceable food disbursement container? Your egg drop soup is already in. And so I just took a drink of soup. And while we're Skyping, and he goes, what is that? What is that, a beverage? And I'm like, oh, that's my lunch. I'm having some egg drop soup. And he goes, you're drinking a whole quart of egg drop soup? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, I think that's baller. And he's like, I've never actually used the word baller before. I've never really known what it means, but I think that I know now. It's like, you're baller. And I felt for this moment, like, you know, I'd crested some sort of, you know, wave. And for that brief shining moment, I was kind of cool.
Well, you know, Pat, here's the thing is that I don't want to break it to you. But neither of us are cool, right? You're extremely uncool. But here's the thing about being so uncool: the amount of uncool that you are is that occasionally your exquisitely uncool, like backcountry affectations, they loop around back into like a bleeding edge hipster trends. So yeah. It's like, here you are, you're drinking broth, you got the delis, you got the belt, you're drinking out of ball jars. It's like you've become like a full Brooklyn hipster.
Ooh.
You got the beard.
Okay. You know, I worry that I might like just accidentally become a hipster. Is that a legitimate fear?
See, that's the most hipster fear of all.
but no, it's that like through not caring and only doing the things that I normally do, like suddenly like all of the random, you know, lottery numbers converge. You hit that 1 in a million thing, and like suddenly I look super fashionable.
But that's, do you understand? That's the most hipster thing to say, because the hipsters hate being hipsters, and they're just like, hey man, I'm just being me. I'm just living myself. And it's like, I just happen to be at home listening to vinyl records, and I pop out to the apothecary to get my mustache wax. And when I pass the pickle store, I see all these fucking hipsters, and I look just like them. Shit, I should have said pickle co-op.
Well, the co-op is assumed, right? Yeah, we should, for those of you tuning in midway, right? Max and what did you say? You're having some scotch?
Well, yeah, I got a little, I think I got a little whiskey, what is it? Oh, yeah, I got a little Jack Daniels going here.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
That's a little baller. I'm going to use that. It'll be my word.
Drinking a little Jack Daniels out of my patented Pat Rothfuss ball jar.
I'm going with my traditional Malibu and pineapple.
And you love the pineapple juice. Explain the pineapple juice to me. for context, we often go out to restaurants and the waitress will come around and get the drink orders and everyone will be like, I'll have water, I'll have coffee, I'll have, you know, whatever. And they get to you and you're like, do you have pineapple juice? And they're always like, what the hell are you talking about?
Well, if I'm at a con and my voice is getting worn out, you know, Mary Robinette Qual actually gave me an old puppetry trick, which sounds like a euphemism, but it's not. You know, she said, you know, warm pineapple juice is actually really good for your throat. I think it's got like glucosamine or something in it. But no, like Malibu and pineapple is my drink of choice.
Is it because it's good for your throat or it just tastes good?
Oh, it will totally taste good too. It's like, well, and you know, everybody drinks orange juice these days. Mm-hmm. So like if you really are into the citrus, like you really go pineapple, you know, I know this great artisanal pineapple place where they juice it while you wait. It's really great.
Here's a pineapple fact that I learned recently. We were at a cards retreat a couple months ago, and we were going to town on some pineapple. We were all going crazy on a pineapple, just going hog on this pineapple. And I don't know if you've ever eaten a bunch of pineapple, and your mouth starts to get weird. Now, we were all like, we've been eating pineapple for like an hour, and I was going like, what is that? My mouth is crazy. And one of the guys pipes up, and they're like, oh, yeah, did you know that pineapple has like some sort of acid or compound in it, and it denatures the proteins in your tongue? It breaks down your taste buds and destroys your tongue?
Ryan Wheaton mentioned that to me just a couple of weeks ago when we were out hanging out. And he's like, yeah, it was the reason it's kind of good on your throat is it kind of dissolves some of your flesh a little bit.
Wow. I got a follow up from one of our listeners. Our listener, Zach, on Twitter is a scientist at Stanford. And he said that he enjoys the podcast. And I said on Twitter, I said, Zach, send me an entertaining science fact. Just expecting, you know, as a matter of course, to be disappointed, as I usually am when I ask people a question like that. You know, where you always ask someone, you're like, tell me a surprising science fact. And they're like, well, you should always check your hypothesis against a control group. And I'm like, no, I want a cool, like, surprising thing. And here's what he said. He said, every snowflake is unique, but there are 35 distinct types shaped by temperature and humidity as they grow.
Oh.
Pretty good.
That is pretty good. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Let's try to do a weekly science fact.
Tweet us your science facts, but no bullshit. I don't care if it's accurate or not. I just want it to be surprised.
Yeah. I would, as a matter of fact, I would prefer something that is untrue.
Mix it up.
Yeah. We're going to throw these out purely. We're not going to vet them. It'll be based entirely on their entertainment value.
So I'm just drunk enough to tell you a story about my parents. You want to hear a good parent story?
I do.
So this was like maybe a month ago or so, a couple weeks ago. My folks called me and they're like, hey, we're downtown and we just got lunch and we want to hang out. Can you come meet us? And, you know, it's like, I'm not sure my parents fully understand what I do, but like I have a sort of a job and like I keep regular hours. So I was like, all right, I'll figure something out. Come meet you. So I moved some stuff around. I came out and met them. And I was like, I can come meet you in a couple hours. And I was like, and they were like, what should we do while we're waiting? And I was like, well, we had just done this really cool thing with cards, which is the city of Chicago operates this little gallery space at the historic Water Tower building downtown. And the city, they do this, they're doing this cool rotating art show called For the Greater Good. And they're like, hey, we really like what you guys are doing at cards. Would you be willing to do a little art show in this gallery and like show all of the crazy projects you've done? You know, you bought the island for people and you sent people bullshit and all of these funny pranks that people know about, and show some of the art and the process and the design behind that. So we did, me and our lead designer Amy and Lauren, our other designer, did this like very cool show, and there's all this like stories of how we made everything, and like you get to see our Photoshop files and all the print stuff that we made. And we're all proud of it, right? Like, we worked really hard on this thing, and, you know, I don't ever like anything I do, but I was like, you know, looking at this is, like, the last 5 years of my life, like, hanging up in a gallery. I was like, this looks pretty cool. So, sure enough, a couple hours later, I meet them at Chicago Design Museum. Chicago Design Museum is this other museum. I have our Project Table Flip, which our listeners know is the this thing that we did together for our World Builders last year. And Table Flip is being exhibited at Chicago Design Museum. So I was going there to set it up. This, I'm only mentioning this because it's important for context that we're in another museum. And we're with the Tanner, who's the curator of Chicago Design Museum, and he's like talking to my folks, and I come in and I'm like, uh-oh, like, you know, my folks are talking to a professional associate of mine, like, this is going to be interesting. So I go up to Tanner and I was like, hey, how was the show, the thing at Water Tower Place? And my dad takes out his phone and he's like, you're not going to believe this. He's like, we went to Water Tower Place, we saw the gallery show, and I found a typo on some of the boards, and I just took out my pen and crossed it right out on the wall of the gallery and fixed it. That's the whole story.
Like, what specifically did he cross off?
I don't know. I sent someone else to, I was too mad about it. I sent someone else to go replace the boards. But I was like, couldn't you? I was like, here's the thing is like, I understand there was a typo in there and that my dad, my folks went and they caught the typo, but it's like, couldn't you have just lied? Like, just come back from the show and just say, hey, it was great. We're really proud of you. Like, you know, it's like a scenario where it's like, just lie to my face. Like, please. What's your deal with your folks? If they read your books?
Yeah. You know, my dad, it's kind of surprising the degree to which my dad like does read them and enjoy them, because he's never been much of a reader. My mom was the big reader. I got a lot of that from her. And, you know, she was always leaving her fantasy books around the house. She got me into The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. I first read The Lord of the Rings, this big red, you know, book that was like as big as a Bible. And it had like this huge map attached to it. It was this beautiful old edition of the Lord of the Rings. But yeah, my mom got a chance to read the first one before she passed away. Because she, and here, this is, you know, let's get maudlin drunk now. She actually was diagnosed with lung cancer, a little bit before, the Name of the Wind got published. And so she didn't actually manage to stick around until it hit the shelf. But my dad, you know, he knows what I do. You know, he knows I do these books. But I feel a little bit the same where, you know, like the other stuff that I do, where like the charity or some of the merchandise we produce, I think he's a little bit baffled by it. Like, he's smart, but, you know, I don't know if I was 70 years old, like how much I would get Kickstarter.
Right.
You know, or more specifically, and that's not true because he knows how Kickstarter works, but. You know, and so it's really wrong for me to paint him that way, but we just did the TAC Kickstarter. And so he's like, so, you know, how does it really go? And so he goes, yeah. But like, how much money do you make? Like, he wanted to know the percentages, like, what was my piece of the action off that Kickstarter?
Yeah, my folks, I think they understand, you know, the mechanics of our business pretty well. But it was like my grandpa who passed away recently, you know, he was like 90. In his 90s, and he was watching a lot of what we were doing with cards, and it was interesting because, like, he was an incredibly smart guy, like one of the smartest people and most technical people I ever knew in my life. And there was just some things where it wasn't like he was dumb and he didn't understand the technology, but it was more of the like social organization around the technology that was totally foreign to him. So like the classic example is like Google. So I taught him how to use a computer, and he would go on the computer and email his old war buddies, and he would go online and like look up missions that he flew in World War II and stuff like that. But he would often ask me, he'd be like, who put my name in Google? Like when I search for this mission, or, you know, when I search for my POW camp or whatever, who put my name in Google? And that's a tough question. I'd be like, well, everybody and nobody.
Yeah.
Right. Where it's like, well, everyone sort of voted on it, and then it decided the best rank. And he's like, I get it, but he's like, but who decided that when you click on that, it was my name would show up? And it's a tough. It's like, I don't think he ever really got it. I think he sort of understood that it was some complex system, but he didn't really grok it. And the same went with Kickstarter, where he was always, and the same went with cards. I think he understood it was like in the newspaper. It was successful by some measure, but he would also tell me, he's like, he'd see a news article and he would email me or we'd talk and he would say, this is great. You should take this to Milton Bradley. They'd probably give you a real job.
Right. Right. Do your folks? Oh boy. Yeah. Okay. I've had a little bit. Get
That's that pineapple. It's denaturing your brain.
Yeah. I'm super denatured right now.
Dude. Just getting denatured with Pat and Max.
You know, we just actually launched the our Indiegogo. We do our mid-season fundraiser, and I know you do a ton of charity as well. Do your parents ever kind of come at you and they're like, "So, like, I know you're doing well for yourself, but you're kind of doing a lot of charity too. Like, are you okay? Like, like they kind of." Worry that your whole job will evaporate and you'll have given away all your money and then we'll have to go back and live in their houses.
So a lot of my family's like feelings about money come from my grandpa Ira, who I was talking about a minute ago, and he's sort of an interesting character. He grew up during the Depression and then he was in a POW camp for a year. He was a bombardier navigator on a B-24 Liberator and he was shot down over Nazi Germany and spent a year in a POW camp. Great stories for another time, but he told me, you know, he was like, when he was in the POW camp, and you think about your life as you do, because you're just sort of like in this awful prison, having your Red Cross rations withheld from you. He was like, you know, he's like, when I get out of here, you know, if I get out of here, I want to lead a life where I never need something and I can't have it.
Yeah.
And I think that came from a little bit of the growing up in the Depression, a little bit of the POW camp. But, you know, he was very proud of, like, he got out of the POW camp, he came back, he started working at a Jewish advertising firm, made a little bit of money and saved it, and then he had $100 in his bank account, made a little bit more money, saved it, then he had $1,000 in his bank account. And by the time he passed away, he was very wealthy. He was, like, a completely self-made man, did very well for himself, and didn't spend anything. He was so frugal. He would save every piece. He would save, if we went to a restaurant that had paper menus and the menu was blank on the back, he would take them, he would fold up the menu and take it because half of it was still good. And he had a filing cabinet in his garage of paper, of half-used paper where one side was still good. And I'd be cleaning out his garage with him and I'd be like, "Grandpa, like, you can afford paper, like, just let's get rid of this." And he'd be like, "You never know." He's like, "Sometime I might need paper and then I have it."
Yeah. You know, what's really interesting is, you know, I think back to, you know, Lake Wobegon, you know, where Garrison Keillor was telling a story about one of the inhabitants. I almost want to think that it was, you know, Florian Krebsbach. You know, heaven forbid I mispronounce a fictional character's name. But, you know, and he talked about how he had been through the Depression and, you know, and he had been through a time in his life where he needed money and there was no work to be had and no money to be got. And, you know, and that had made it so that, you know, he never wanted to be in that position again. And so he did. And so you become sort of a financial hoarder, which, again, is not a bad fiscal philosophy. But, you know, in some ways, if you die with $1 million in the bank, you kind of haven't taken advantage of all the opportunities you might have. My dad always jokes, you know, he says, I always hear, I read those obituaries, somebody says, "Oh yeah, he died penniless," and my dad's like, "That sounds like pretty good timing to me." he goes, I'm going to burn through as much of this as I can before I go. Screw you, kids. But you know, my dad, to call it hoarding, I think is really unfair, because you know, like my dad built most of the house, and if we needed a step stool, he would go and make one in his wood shop. And so what you learn is that like having bits of 2x4 or, you know, drywall or extra screws around is like super useful. And like now that I don't have projects like that or a wood shop, I do occasionally, I'm like, "Oh, I can do this. All I need is a couple of shims and, oh, I don't have any of that, you know?" so like kind of accumulating those little odds and ends is, you know, I'm not part of that culture these days. I haven't done that sort of thing. But I think if you go back, like legitimately far back to where, you know, our parents are those of us with older parents or grandparents, you go back to when they were kids. I think it goes back to like the Little House in the Prairie days and some of that mentality. And even though Chicago is further removed from this, like you read those Little House in the Prairie books and they go into town and they buy a few things with the money that Pa gets from like selling his furs. But I'm like not even exaggerating. They come back and they each get, the girls get like a piece of candy, and Pa gets to buy some like store-bought nails, and you know, they buy some fabric. But one of the things they bought comes wrapped in paper. And then Ma saves that paper and uses it to make curtains for one of the other houses. Like when they move further out into the freaking hinterlands, she, you know, and they're like, well, Pa planed the wood and pounded this together and made pegs instead of nails. Now we have a house. And Ma's like, okay. And she brings out this piece of paper she's saved and uses it to make curtains to make this place pretty. And it's like, there's literally no waste in these people's lives because nothing is disposable. And like they make a doll out of the rags from somebody's shirt that they made three books ago, because like you don't have enough to waste anything.
Is that because the people are more industrious, or is it because the stuff is better? Because part of me wants to think like, okay, well, it's like every few years I just throw out like half of an IKEA furniture set because, you know, something breaks and then I need to replace it. But it's like, I don't have the option of refashioning that IKEA furniture set into some sort of usable thing, because it's all garbage. It's all like MDF, you know, particle board and, you know, like stuffed with newspaper.
I think that is a definite piece of it. But I also think it's raw utility. It's wrong to be too nostalgic about it. Because it's like the only reason you make curtains out of a piece of tissue paper that you've saved is because you have nothing, you know? It's like, it seems a little charming in hindsight, but, you know, like, you know, and again, it's a time that it's almost impossible for us to conceptualize. But, you know, I see the shadows of it in my own life now, because my mom did sewing. My mom could like actually sew you like a real piece of clothing from nothing but a pattern and some cloth. And she had a button jar, which fascinated. I played with the button jar as a kid and I never really thought about it, but it's kind of a weird thing to have, like a big, you know, effectively a ball jar, like with hundreds of odd buttons in it. But it's not weird if you realize that my mom probably learned to sew from her mom, and her mom was probably only one or two generations removed from this like 1880s. Like if you get rid of a piece of clothing, you save those buttons because you just don't have fucking money or even maybe a store to go buy buttons at. It's weird. And honestly, one of the biggest things, I didn't even get this impression from fantasy novels. You'd think that I would have learned some of that. I got it all from those Little House on the Prairie books that I recently read to my boys.
did any of your, in your family, did any of your grandparents have like a job? Like, I think it's the blogger, John Gruber, has said like his grandfather was like a coal miner and now he like writes a blog about Apple for a living. And he just thinks about how crazy that is. And like, yeah. on my side of the family, like my dad's father worked in a pepper factory. And like now I write like fart jokes for a living.
You know, one of the things that I kind of use as a truism, and I'd love to see some stats, but I say, you know, here in Wisconsin, I bet that 70% of the population is no more than three generations removed from farmers. And I would probably lay a fair wager on that completely, you know, I've just, that's my guess statistic. I've done no research there, but you know, my mom and my dad both would visit the family farm, you know, like that their parents owned the land or whatever. My dad would tell jokes about, you know, when he was 8 years old and he went out and, you know, one of the cousins was milking the cow and he goes, "You want to try?" And my dad says, "Sure." And he goes, "You milk that cow over there." And of course it was a bull. Cause that's what you do to your, like your cousin who isn't a farm kid, who's coming to visit the farm. You know, if you think of that, where if you grow up on the farm, it really instills a whole different mentality into your whole life where you have to be supremely self-sufficient.
Yeah. You got to drink out of deli tanners.
Yeah. You know, I can't claim credit for that. I'm just barbarous and lazy.
Pat, that's what that is the Native American way. You use every part of the takeout.
You know, God, actually that does come full circle, doesn't it? Me drinking out of those deli containers is exactly the same as Ma Ingalls using that piece of waste paper. Like, you know, or I always, my mom and my grandpa would do the same thing. Like, for presents, when somebody was opening a present, they would say, "Oh, this is super nice paper." And they would try to cut or tear it off in such a way that they could save the wrapping paper. And, you know, I remember us as kids being like, "What is wrong with you?" And it's like, well, nothing's wrong with them. It's that there's the echoes of this old culture where it's like, you save that because, you know, hell, you'll trade it for nails in a couple of months or something like that.
Do you you don't strike me as a big present wrapper. Are you a present wrapper?
I'm the worst present wrapper ever. Everyone knows which presents are mine because they are the ugliest things under the tree or around the cake.
I barely, so if it's up to me, I don't wrap presents. I just give people something and I'm like, "Here's the thing I bought you."
Yeah,
because like, what's the point? They're gonna open it up and see it in 1 second anyway. But then, so occasionally, someone will tell me like it's for social reasons I'm required to wrap something, and then it's like I usually just wrap it in whatever garbage is lying around, or it's like I've managed to compromise with Veronica where I have like brown butcher paper, which I find like acceptable to have a roll of to wrap a present in. So now I wrap everything in like a brown butcher paper. And normally Veronica will wrap it for me, and she knows how to do it where you just use two pieces of tape to seal it all together in a tidy, tight corner fashion. But so all the presents that we give, like when we do Christmas at her family's, all the presents look amazing because she wraps them all, except for hers, because I wrap those, and it's just like a wad of brown construction paper, and then I sort of like embalm it in a layer of scotch tape. it's like mummified in there. There's like a jar of honey and all of my servants.
The other thing for me is like I get bored because most of what I give away, you know, as presents is books, because I don't know about anything else. But I'm pretty confident, like, if I'm not friends with people who don't like books, and so if I'm going to give someone a present, I'm going to stick with what I know. But wrapping a bunch of square things is pretty boring. And cutting out a square piece of paper and then wrapping it around a square thing. So for a while, I would just kind of cut the paper into random shapes and then see if I could make it fit. including like I tried that like one piece of tape wrapping. But because I'm not dexterous or subtle or spatially aware, I would just cut a super long strip of wrapping paper and like wind it around. I would all like literally mummify the book,
yeah,
trying to wrap it around in such a way that it covered the entire present, but there were no right angles. And see, that's the sort of thing you assume the person would be drinking, but no, I would just do that out of pure cussedness.
It's just like, what pleasure could someone get out of having a nicely wrapped present? Like, good Lord, like, just like get rid of the paper and just look at the present. How about put it in a box?
One Christmas I had one gift bag and I had a big box of stuff at my feet, and so I put a present in the gift bag, and then I'm like, "Hey, this is for you." And I stuffed a piece of tissue paper on top. And I give it, and they take the tissue paper off, and they take the present off. They're like, out, and they're like, oh, yay. And then I'm like, can I have that gift bag back? And they'd give it back to me. And then I would just put a new present in there. I use the same gift bag for, you know, 30 or 40 presents. The same piece of tissue paper, too. I need the tissue paper back to go on top, right?
Hey, kids, it's Christmas. Everybody open this deli-tainer one by one and get your present. Here's what I thought of a half hour too late. You know what my parents should have said to me when they came back from that museum show where they saw they found the typos on the wall? Is not that I'm upset about it, and I'm still thinking about it 2 months later. But you know, one time you came into our to visit the office, and one of the people who works for us came up to you, and I'm not 100% sure if they knew who you were or not. And she was like, "Hello, I am working on this piece of fiction. Would you take a look at it for me?" And you were incredibly gracious, and you were like, "Absolutely, I'd be happy to take a look." And you read through it, and then you were like, "You said to her one of the smartest things I've ever heard in my life." You said, tell me, I'm paraphrasing here, so you have to tell me exactly how you put this, but you were like, what kind of criticism do you want from a 1 to a 10? Where a 1 is like, I'll just tell you the things I liked, and a 10 is like, I'll rip into it.
I used to do a lot of peer tutoring when I was a student, and so I got to be really, really good at giving feedback on writing even before I became a teacher. And then I was a teacher, and of course, you know, being a writer myself and critiquing stuff. So yeah, it's very old hat to me by now.
What do you say to people? Did I get it right?
It's pretty close. Like sometimes I'll say, you know, I'll look for a spectrum, or I'll say, you know, like where one is, I'm going to kind of pet you and tell you that keep going, you know, keep on trucking, soldier. You are the word make, you know. I'm paraphrasing there, and that's a really badly mixed metaphor too. You know, soldiers don't truck, I don't think. And whereas a 10 would be, I would fit it in. I'd feed this piece of writing into the chipper shredder that is the critical faculty that I use on my own work, which is not pleasant for anyone to experience. But also, what I'll say is, what are you wondering about? What are you curious about? You know, what are you worried about? And from there, you also want to say, like, so what are you trying to achieve? Because, you know, if I read your story and I'm like, you know, it was a mess, I didn't laugh once, and they're like, it's not humor, then you failed as a beta reader as well.
You know what someone would say, if someone hijacked your office, like Captain Phillips, the guy would come up to you and say, I am the word make now.
The word make.
What? All right. I'm sorry. I didn't want to derail us on this. So you tell people. So you ask people, pat on the head or feed it through the chipper. Does that? So I often struggle with this, right? Because I usually I have the amount of self-loathing that I have that I just politely assume that everyone has. Is that if I give someone, if I specifically ask someone for criticism on something, I'm actually like specifically expecting them to disassemble it and to find its flaws that I know that emotionally that it has, right? Like if I know something's good, I usually will just sort of give it to someone and be like, here, enjoy this. I will not say like, you know, please criticize it or edit it. You know, I know that it's deeply, deeply flawed and bad if I ask someone for feedback, and I'm looking for that. And if they come back and they're like, oh, this was really funny, or it was really good and I liked it, I'm always, my natural assumption is to be very suspicious, and I'll like squint at them and I'll be like, did you read it? Like, what's going on here? Like, it's like I can't like accept that it's good. Right. So I often assume that everyone else is the same way, and it's wrong.
That's something that I've struggled with my whole life, and I knew about it dimly. You know, I've known about it dimly for 20 years, but it's only now, you know, where I feel like I've actually, this is the difference between intelligence and wisdom, where like me and a friend at one point, you know, we would talk about how frustrated we were in our relationships because, you know, our partners would complain about things. And so we would try to help them and fix those things. And then they would get angry. And so we felt really wronged. You know, it's like you're complaining, you're unhappy, so we're going to help, and now you're angry that we're like, why else would you tell me that you're unhappy if you didn't want me to fix this?
And this is how I think. It's like, why would I even have a dissatisfaction about the world that I couldn't fix?
Yes. Oh, God. Yeah. Which of course, is why we end up miserable, you realize.
Clearly not, or I wouldn't be miserable.
We talked about the ducks on the last episode, didn't we?
The what now?
Where, like, I was out at the park with my kids, and a mama duck had built a nest under the slide in the playground. Did I tell you about this?
No.
Where, you know, so, you know, it's springtime, and that means mama ducks are making nests and laying eggs. And so, like, right there under the slide, under one of those tiny slides for the little kids, this mama duck had made her nest in there in the wood chips. And I took a picture of, you know, and I'm like, what the hell am I going to do now? Because, you know, either, you know, some jackass kid is going to go in and torture this mama duck and ruin these eggs, or some little toddler is going to go, oh, duck, and like get in there, and this duck is going to wreck them, you know? Like, there's no possible good interaction between like children and this mama duck. And so I just stood there and I stared at it Saturday afternoon, and I took a picture of it and I put it on Twitter, and I'm like, guys, what do I do about this? How do I fix this problem? And a friend bounced back to me. She goes, you know, you don't actually have to fix everything in the world. And then I replied, I do not actually know that. She's like, you know, you don't actually have to fix this. I'm like, no, I do not know that. Thank you very much.
But it's like, you chose to notice it. Why wouldn't you fix it?
Right. I mean, it's not that I chose to notice it. It's that I am an observant person moving through the world. I'm also intelligent, which means I can look into the future and see things that have not occurred, but that will in all likelihood occur. And with those two faculties, yes, if I then ignore this problem, I become complicit in the problem. So of course I have to fix it. It's the only reasonable solution. And now here's what's funny is somebody else looped in the mayor of Stevens Point, you know? And he said, and so like, you know, 18 hours had gone by and somebody goes, hey, who should we call about this? And he goes, oh, okay. Yeah, I know a guy. I'll give him a call. And so like a lot of times people say, so when you move to New York, now that you're a successful writer, when you go into Seattle, when you move into the big city. And I'm like, you know, when it's like when the mayor of New York City gives a shit about a duck. That's why I belong in Stevens Point.
And what happened with the duck? Was it attended to?
Well, you know, that's, you know, I wasn't going to talk about it, but I think it bears talking about, because here's the out for people like us, Max. And it ties into, actually, this ties back to the Marvel discussion we were having. Like if we're Tony Starks, who, like, you just have to put a suit of armor around the world, you have to fix these things. You know, the difference is, like, Captain America knows that sometimes you do everything right and it doesn't work. And the only thing you can do, your duty then, is to say, let's look to the future and try to do better, but you can't beat yourself up. And Tony Stark hasn't learned that lesson. It's because Tony keeps beating himself up that he can't actually move forward and do the good that he could do in the world. And so I contacted the mayor, honestly, because I saw another duck. It was mama duck and it had a hurt leg and it had like 8 baby ducks with it. And so I'm like, oh, and I DM'd the mayor on Twitter. And I'm like, what was the number of the guy that you called? And he misunderstood why I was asking. And he goes, oh, here he is. He's a cool guy. Here's his number. He goes, just to let you know, though, the story doesn't really have a happy ending. And I told him the truth. And I said, you know, oh, that's too bad. I go, but don't feel bad. The important thing is that you cared and that you did what you could. Because all any of us can do is what you can do, but you're not actually in control of the outcome. And I know that is the problem. That's my problem. Not that I want to fix the world. I think people should want to fix the world. The problem is that I feel like I can control the world. And that's where my unhappiness comes from. That's where I get angry or I get frustrated when that expectation is defeated.
You make a rogue Iron Man suit.
Oh, I make 1,000 fucking rogue Iron Man suits.
Man, we're all over the place. I think we're good.
Yeah, this is actually, I think this will be a pretty good one.
This is a weird good one.
Yeah. And you know, we could just make this a theme of the entire rest of the podcast is we'll just do a different consciousness altering substance for each podcast.
Okay.
But we won't necessarily announce which one and people can vote as to which one it is.
All right, next week we'll trip on acid and do the podcast.
No, now you gave it away.
Okay. Sure. Oh my God, Pat, have you ever really looked at your hands? I mean, have you ever really thought about what eating? I mean, what is eating? It's like you just eat stuff, and you just chew it up and it goes in your body.
If I'm just the stuff that I've eaten, like how, like, am I still the person that I used to be? am I just like the dreams of like dead fish and stuff?
All right. I gotta go skateboard home like a grown up.